Greetings, Meltopians. Are you looking to delve deeper into the world of Meltopia? Then check out our Patreon, where you can find written mythos pieces, world maps, found footage, art, Patreon-exclusive shows, and more. Just go to patreon.com/Meltopia and join one of our tiers for access to great new content. Brave the forbidden and embrace the darkness.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello again, and welcome to The Weird Book. I'm Steve Luciano.
And I'm Sasha Abramoff. Welcome back, everybody.
And we've got a good show for you today. A bit creepy, a bit, different from what we usually do, which is we usually take on more contemporary phenomenon or things that have happened recently. This one's going to go back quite a ways as we talk about what is called the mass possession of 1666.
Yeah, this is way, way back. That is true.
And the reason you may not have heard of the mass possession of 1666 is it's not talked about very much. It's not something that's within the mainstream culture. It's actually only talked about in a series of or a couple of different books from different perspectives. But basically, giving a definition of what the mass possession of 1666 was it was a time when demonic possessions all over the world were supposedly taking place at an elevated rate. So apparently in 1666, you know, the triple sixes, there was a massive increase in demonic possessions. And we'll start to get into the actual reasons for that in a bit. But mass possessions is a thing even today. There have been various mass possession cases historically. Let's see, what's the I'm going to butcher this name. The Loudun, is that how you say it? Loudun possessions of 16.
Loudun possessions. Oh, yeah, it's French.
It's French. So you gotta say fancy. The Loudun possessions of 1634, which involved a convent of Ursuline nuns who were supposedly possessed. I don't know what an Ursuline nun is. I know what nuns are. Do you know what an Ursuline nun is?
Well, essentially, this was a place where, as you would describe them, the unwed women, when they were kind of rearing, they were kind of like, they were approaching the age where they could not bear children. Or they were unwanted in some ways, and or they were deformed, like the nun and the other covenant that we're gonna cover as well.
Oh,
yeah, they were just basically brides that kind of never kind of interested a suitor, and so they were often from well-to-do families, so they didn't quite know what to do with them, so they would put them in these covenants when they would become nuns. They would become brides of Jesus, basically, brides of Christ.
Jesus, that sounds terrible. But
apparently that was a noble thing, to have in your family.
I guess. It's just it's what you do with the old spinsters, I guess. I guess that's what
Seems ghastly to us right now, but that was a very noble kind of thing. And apparently there was a list, and I'm not sure it was a waiting period, but it wasn't easy to become a nun in one of those places. It wasn't readily accessible to everyone.
Gotcha. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. In regards to the possession, they found this convent and they apparently determined that this convent was reported to be full of possessed Ursuline nuns. The church later determined that this occurred because of the summoning of spirits by a priest called Gandier, I think his name was, who was summarily convicted and burned at the stake as... That's just what you do to, you know, people who conjure devils and make deals with the devil and what have you. But this was a mass possession. This was one where there were a multitude of women who were possessed. It was unclear whether Gandier or however you pronounce his name is, was possessed himself. He's the one who was supposedly summoning the spirits, though.
He was what is known from the investigation was the fact that he did admit to being a womanizer. He always professed his innocence in terms of being a warlock, you would say, or a witch. He always denied the fact that he had brought this upon. But the witnesses, I mean, there are so many of them. I mean, these executions of these nuns took place almost daily and just didn't, I mean, except for Sundays. They took, I guess, a break. The Catholic Church actually sent out a brigade of priests that would exorcise these nuns, and, you know, thousands of people have witnessed this over the period. Now it crescendoed in 1634, but the possessions have been going on for a few years before then, and they would subside, and then they would just get worse with time.
Yeah, apparently there was an epidemic of Ursuline nuns being possessed, as when you get into the, again, going to butcher this, the Aixen province possessions, which happened in 1611, which is what really actually set the precedent for the Loudun possessions.
It's called Aixen Provence. In fact, the kind of also involved in the execution of a priest who was also kind of overseeing the nuns in Aixen Provence in this covenant. And actually, his execution led to the case that would ultimately result in the execution of the priest in Loudun. But in Loudun, it was just specifically nasty because the priest was supposed to be given a word to speak that was denied. He was practically waterboarded with holy water. And then the executioner was supposed to strangle him before he was to be burned at the stake, but that was not done. He was burned at the stake immediately. And the only things apparently that he was able to utter was the fact that the person who set him, which was also a priest, those that performed the exorcism, the last words uttered by the priest as he was burning alive was the fact that you will die in 30 days, and which is apparently, according to the records, the priest did meet his untimely end 30 days later, one of those things.
Interesting. Huh. And that was Gandier, right? Or Gandier?
That's correct. He professed the fact that, yes, he admitted to the fact that he was a womanizer, but he always, you know, kept his innocence in terms of witchcraft or anything like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, that tends to be a trend with them accusing people of possession and them and people denying that. But obviously, there's a lot of this stuff that happened for political reasons. But the accent
it was an infighting between the Protestants and the Catholics, and kind of the Catholics taking over as the predominant Christian religion in the region.
In 1611, which took place before the Loudun possessions, again, it was Ursuline nuns who were found to be possessed. And this was thought to be due to a pact with the devil, which was established by Louis Goffredi. I'm sure, again, that I'm mispronouncing that. He met a pretty terrible end. He was tortured by Strapado, which I checked into, which is apparently where you are lifted up by rope, and I believe you are bound by your wrists behind your back so that your weight then dislocates your shoulders, and I think you end up suffocating to death. But I can't imagine it's very good. But he didn't die by that. Apparently they just did that and tortured him for a while, and then later he was executed by strangulation. But like Sasha said, this was the case that served as kind of the precedence for the Loudun possessions. Mm-hmm. And then, those were preceding the mass possessions of 1666. And where we're going to deviate here is that, Loudun possessions and the Aixen Provence possessions, whether they were actual legit possessions, we don't know. I mean, there was obviously reports that these women demonstrated, demonic type features, speaking in
feats of strength, speaking in tongues, you name it, sexually lewd acts, things of that, just kind of things that you would kind of associate with possessions.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. With demonic possessions, at least.
So but the possessions we're going to be talking about, 1666, seem to be they're different, but there's some significant differences. Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
No, they're always kind of connecting factors to them. There's another possession that we will discuss. We'll mention that the New Mexico colony possession. And there are some similarities to that as well.
Yeah, that one was after the 1600s. That one is in 1764. But that one was weird. And, there were a priest had reported, I believe he reported back to the Roman Church. I'm not 100% sure. But he had reported that there was mass possession and that, for instance, this woman, Maria Trujillo, who basically suffered melancholy after birth and showed, sadness that she couldn't be cheered up after she gave birth, which nowadays we would just call postpartum disorder. He saw this as a sign of possession. Also, she did apparently show remarkable bouts of strength, speaking in tongues, excuse me. And then there were others in the villages claiming to hear pig noises and sheep noises and other animal noises that
and
weren't
that,
present.
That is a very common in both the Loudon possession and the Aix-en-Provence. They also heard pigs and things like that. They heard whispers, and that's the commonalities between those. But yeah, the New Mexico colony at that time, 1764, that was a Spanish colony. You know, so it reported to the, directly to back to Spain in terms of that. And, you know, the priest basically stated that, hey, I've got these occurrences. And, you know, it started with this woman who could not be cheered up as what they would say, basically. And, you know, they put her through grueling tasks of just praying constantly. And that would involve, you know, fasting. And essentially, at one point, she collapsed. And when she came to, she was described as being possessed by something. She showed just tremendous feats. She was, you know, foaming at the mouth, vomiting, all sorts of, you know, I don't know, just disgusting things happening. And then it kind of caught on, and there was a few other women, and I think also included a man that also fell into this kind of state. And essentially, the father declared an epidemic of possessions in that region.
Yeah, it was really interesting. They cited seizures and stuff. And a lot of this stuff, like I said, could be accountable or explained away, you know, currently as, you know, seizures, schizophrenia, all these types of things. But there were, like you said, that there were some odd, weird things that were going on there. But, you know, those are just some examples we wanted to give of mass possessions, historically speaking, before we got into the great possession or the mass possession of 1666, which, by the way, I think this is a good time where we can introduce our guest, who has That's decided right. to remain anonymous due to the information that she's going to be divulging. We'll simply refer to her as Anna. Anna, say hi.
Great to be on the show. Big listener, and I think you guys are doing great work, and I'm happy to be here, happy to help inform about the great possession of 1666.
Great.
Anna, thank you so much for being here. We really, really, really appreciate you coming in. And like I said, we just want to reiterate that is not your real name. Your name is being kept private, but what you've got to share with our listeners and with us today is very, very important. And hey, we're all ears. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so how do we know about the Great Possession of 1666? As most people know that most people haven't heard of the Great Possession of 66, and that's because the information pertaining to it is recorded in only a few books. And some of these books, the books are the Weird Book organization has access to some copies of these books. But I believe Anna brought a copy of Interview with the Damned, which is rare.
Yes, I have a copy of the Interview with the Damned. It's one of the few copies in the world, actually. There's only two or three.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So we'll be getting information from that. But here are the books. We have the Journal of Judas Bardot, which we'll get into. The Writings of Pontiff Calabrodin. The Chronicles of Turgo Volkov. And is that how you say it, Sasha? Volkov?
Volkov means of wolves. Okay,
gotcha. And then we have the Interviews with the Damned. So let's jump into it. First, I'd like to discuss what the origins of the mass possession of 1666 is. And there's various looking at the literature, there's various origin stories of what actually happened during 1666. Anna, would you seem to know a lot more about these particular aspects of it. So would you mind going through it?
Sure.
Yes, please. Sure.
So the various myths include, the first is that the Catholic Church discovered a sin eater. Now, if you're familiar with sin eaters, oftentimes these were people who would come to a house of oftentimes a lofty, rich person and would basically take their sins away. A lot of times what would happen is they put food on the chest of the person who died, and the sin is essentially soaked into the bread, and then the sin eater comes and performs a ritual and then eats the bread. And then it's considered, the sins are considered consumed, and that person no longer bears the burden of those sins and then can thus go into heaven sinless. So the myth, or one of the origin stories, is that the Catholic Church discovered a sin eater and found his practices sacrilegious, as the Catholic Church eventually found sin eating to be sacrilegious and was outlawed or not allowed to be practiced anymore. As a result, the church had him executed, and all of the sins that were in this particular sin eater had been released into the world. And this was reported by Turgot Volkov. This was his particular account of how the mass possessions of 1666 occurred. The one that I would say is the most accurate, based on the evidence, is there was a casket that was excavated from the earth, and inside, and this is in 1666, I believe, a casket was excavated from the earth, and inside was a man covered in strange tattoos. The church didn't know what to do with it, but they found that upon opening the casket, the man was alive, and this was considered an abomination. And so he was executed, and this caused the release of thousands of demons throughout the world. As we'll get into in a little bit, this man is referred to as the first son of Solomon, and we'll get into why that's significant in a bit, but there's also a rumor that there was an exorcism that was performed on a serpent line. And if you're familiar with ley lines, these geographical lines that span the earth that are said to be made up of positive and negative energies, you have the serpent line, which is made up of dark energy, of evil energies, in that this exorcism was performed on a serpent line and had the opposite effect. So instead of exorcising the demons, the caused a reverse exorcism and the proliferation of demons across the world in possessing all these individuals around the world. And that was talked about by in the writings of Pontiff Calibroden.
Thanks, Anna. So these origin stories, we don't know which ones are true, which ones are just myth, if they're all myths. Anna, you have a bit more information. Yeah, go ahead.
They're kind of well mixed in. They're kind of well mixed into this kind of like the ethos of it.
Yeah. So we have these, we'll start off with the cases of mass possession. For instance, the case of mass possession in 1666 in the, you pronounce this, Sasha, Suzdal or?
Suzdal.
Suzdal. Suzdal. Mass possession.
Just consider that to be like a province of Moscow. It's not too far.
Oh, I see. And you said it's like 1,000 years old?
It's about 1,000 years old. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
It's a lot of churches, a lot of old kind of picturesque buildings, but around it is a lot of moors and a lot of really small villages and communities and just, you know, a lot of it's provincial places, and it's, you know, steeped in mystery and all sorts of mythology, you know, that you have with Slavic mythology, basically.
Interesting. So here we have reports of a woman by the name of Galina Orlov. And she was said to be exhibiting odd behavior, creeping into houses, and supposedly whispering dark secrets to those who had dark secrets to keep, who she shouldn't have known any of that. And she would sneak into these houses in unknown ways and go to the sleeping people and start whispering these secrets. And it said that those she spoke to became possessed as well and started to display bizarre behaviors, you know, such as living in small snow caves with threadbare clothing. They were also said to be crawling on the ceilings of their homes and on the village walls. They were even said to strangely run on all fours and hunt down dogs and eat them. And they, you know, also telltale signs of possessions. So they possess superhuman strength, senses, spoken tongues, what have you. And it was rumored that the town priest tried to exorcise Galina Orlov, but instead he was killed and eaten by the possessed. A man appeared in the town, and this is where it gets kind of even more weird. The man, according to the reports, was covered in these strange tattoos. And what he did was, he barely talked to the town folk. He simply wanted to know where the possessed were and that he would take care of the problem. And he used himself as bait and lured all the possessed into a large barn. The townsfolk claimed that a terrible screaming took place, could be heard for days and upon days of the howling of the men and women. And when the man reemerged, the possessed were all laying unconscious, and the mysterious man left the village. And oddly, they claimed they could hear the screams of demons following the man as he left the village. That was one of the things that they reported. And Anna, this is right. This is from the interviews with the Damned, correct?
Yes, this particular case was from the interviews with the Damned. And this is something that we're going to see many times in the exorcisms of 1666 of these strange tattoos. As I'll get into the history of a little bit of this, you see, once the mass possession of 1666 occurred, a mass union between the world's major religions met in secret during that year to discuss and deal with the possession crisis. And this was the beginning of what would become come to be called the One Church. Now, this is where people will accuse me of conspiracy theory, that there's this organization that's a conglomeration of the world's religions and monotheistic religions, especially, have formed this kind of organization called the One Church. But one of the One Church's first acts were to back engineer the signs of Solomon and use them to detain demons. Now, this goes back to the man who was covered in tattoos and who was buried in this casket and had these strange signs on him. These came to be called the signs of Solomon. And what they found out is that the signs of Solomon could be used to imprison a demon. Those who bore the sign of Solomon could take a demon inside them and imprison it. And that's essentially how they got out. That's how they figured out. They back-engineered this man that they found, who they executed, and then realized that they had released all these demons and then kind of back-engineered the symbol. And so they started creating almost like this militant's arm of exorcists who bore the sign of Solomon. And that is what we call the story of this man with the tattoos is what we commonly call a Solominian, who are trained individuals who bear the seal of Solomon. And it's an ancient symbol of great power that seals and imprisons demons within the bear. So we see this a lot in the book, and actually several of the books, but we see it in the writings of the interview with Dan.
Oh, thanks, Anna. So let's we let's go to another example. We have the possession of Talonborough, which is in England. So rumors from the surrounding towns of Talonborough were reporting livestock and even people going missing, which is kind of like a staple of these types of situations. One woman reported seeing a flying lady pick up her little cousin from the air like a hunting eagle and fly away in the direction of Talonborough. Others claim to see people crawling into the mouths of cattle and then walking them to the town of Talonborough. Really bizarre stuff. And soon the the towns were, you know, all worried and informed of this evil presence, and Judas Bardot was summoned to perform a cleansing of the town. Now, this how they summoned Judas Bardot is unknown. He simply says he came to this town upon the beckoning of his authorities. Upon entering the town, Bardot would have a conversation. For instance, you know, in his journals, he would talk about how he would go into this town, this Talonborough, for instance. And there are many such examples, many towns he went into. And he would have a conversation with one of the citizens and then continue that conversation with a completely different person as if that person somehow had the information transferred to them, as if they were all one person and they were just in different bodies. He found the people living in filth, and there were corpses of animals and people they had murdered. And when he finally got to the point where he talked to this entity, which was possessing all the, it seemed to be one entity possessing the almost the whole town. The entity claimed to be from a place called Garuzela. And Bardot spent days with the possessed and eventually stated that he exorcised the demons by taking them into himself. And this is where he became known as Judas the Demon Eater. And that's from the journal of Judas Bardot. But it is interesting, as Anna pointed out, this idea of exorcising demons by basically bringing them into yourself to be operating as a biological prison for demons. And he, going back to your point, Anna, he does allude to a secret organization and referred to himself as a Salaminian, claiming he was a living prison for the demons he exorcised. Right, Anna?
Yes, Judas Bardot was a well-known Salaminian, at least within these texts. And the organization that he is alluding to, I believe, is the One Church. Now, the reason I don't want my identity known is that the One Church does not want people to know that it exists. There are, I have my sources who would not have a pleasant fate if they were ever found out as to be leaking that information. But the One Church is definitely an organization that wants to maintain an anonymity and not to be known. But yes, Judas Bardot, I believe, based on my research, was a member of the One Church.
But so we have these Salaminians, and they're going around the world, apparently, and they're taking these demons into themselves. And via this weird sigil, this sign of Solomon.
Well, it almost sounds as if, you know, they're following him, as if they're it's almost reminiscent of the Piper of Belen, you know, the legend.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that he was, you know, they paid this piper to get rid of their rat problem. They didn't pay him. And then he somehow lured all the children away. This sounds almost kind of, this guy was a piper that lured out the demons.
Yeah.
Oh, no, Salaminians, I mean, lured out the demons. And it's kind of what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just bizarre stuff.
It's just really weird stuff. And you know, and it goes on. You know, we had the Demons of Dunmire, which was in Maryland, which was a colony at the time. The United States didn't exist at that point, but was the Maryland colony. Dunmire was a small outpost just outside the Maryland colony. This is where criminals, killers, thieves, and other outlaws were kept. And there were reports of people running on all fours, climbing trees with the ease of like a monkey, and some were said to eat fire and capture people from the colony and sacrifice them, all sorts of debauchery and, you know, what you would come to expect from a possession type case. And, it, you know, this one had a weird one. It was oddly reported that the people in the outpost combined with one another to create this like hideous conglomerate creature, which was described as like writhing arms and legs that like their all their legs would combine and it would move in this like spider like way. But it was comprised of all of them. But like their bodies were all twisted and broken, which is something that we see in some possession cases. And, you know, the most famous example being the movie The Exorcist, where her head turns completely around and where she walks backwards down the stairs, where, you know, you have these odd contortions of the body or the ability to do things to the body that wouldn't normally be able to be done. And then, Anna, would you explain the rest of this? Because you'd have a better grasp of it, I believe.
Yes. So the strange occurrences were reported and help was sent by the local pastor. So they sent letter back to England and the ships were sent. And a group of strange men arrived by boat wearing black and red garb. And if you remember earlier, I believe it was mentioned that, or did, I believe it was Bardot who was wearing red and black, if I remember correctly. And these people were wearing the same type of attire. And they arrived and they went to the outpost of Dunmere. Over the course of several days, again, the people, the colony of Maryland, heard horrible sounds. One witness said individuals were being separated and strange rituals were being performed. Now, these rituals, according to Pontiff Caleb Broden, who was the one at the time who was who reported all these activities, included a ceremony where the possessed would be strapped down and then branded with a strange symbol. Now, as I've mentioned before, we have the Salaminians who just happened to be to bore a symbol of some sort on their body. And this seems to be, I would conjecture, based on my research, that the symbol that Caleb Broden is referencing is the sign of Salomon. The only difference in this particular situation is that the men who came did not have the tattoos, but rather what they were doing was branding these people with the symbol. And they did this with each of the 15 people who were possessed, and that was about the size of the little enclave. Kel Bruden reported that once they were branded, some were bound up and imprisoned. Some were stored and forced to sleep in holy water. Others were strapped to beds of crucifixes. And he got a little information out of them. It was for those where the demon could not properly contained. And the possessed were put in large metal coffins that were wrapped and chained and buried in the ground. The rest were taken, according to the Calibron, they boxed them up, essentially, and they took them back in crates on the boats. And this, to me, strikes of a kind of, the idea is that the Salaminians are these trained exorcists. They go through years of training, from what I understand, from what I've been told, and are essentially warriors for the one church. And they are practiced their condition to do this. But in a pinch, especially in the mass possession of 1666, the issue was that there just weren't enough of them. So what they did was they would brand these people with the sign of Solomon, which would trap the demon inside of them. And then to basically fortify the prison, the living prison, they would put them on bed of crosses or make them sleep in holy water. Or if it couldn't be contained, they'd wrap them in a coffin and bury them, which is the same thing that happened, which was one of the origins of the mass possession to begin with, was a man found with these sigils all over his body, found in a coffin, still alive, presumably kept alive by the demons inside of him, and then summarily executed. But like I said, in this case, they seem to have just branded the people and then contained them.
Thanks, Anna, for clarifying that stuff. And this was
Anna. Do we have any like any indications of what the tattoos were like? Anything of that notion?
Not that I know of. Anna, do you know?
Well, I have. There are some interpretations of it. What the Sign of Solomon looks like. It's a very complex glyph. It's ancient, but I haven't actually been able to get a bead on that, actually, even through my sources. It's a very sacred sign, so that, I don't have access to that, regrettably. Sorry.
Hmm. Interesting. So there are, you know, you said, Anna, that there was some other instances of this type before we talked on the show. You said there were other instances of this type of branding where it wasn't done. The demons weren't taken in by professional, I say professional, but trained Solominians. Is that correct?
Yes. Other instances of this type of possession related to like the imprisonment of the demons via the Sign of Solomon on the victim was seen in the Callimore possessions of Talatos, the Briton. The Hague sisters' possessions in the small township of Izium in the Ukraine, the darkening of Arcanus, Greece, it goes on, all included strange holy men wearing black and red and branding or tattooing strange symbols onto the possessed. And this can be all found in the interviews of the damn text.
Hmm. That's really interesting that they had this. So it was the epidemic, the pandemic, I should say, was on such a level that they couldn't just send out these guys. They had to actually basically imprison them within the victims themselves. Is that correct?
Yes, that's exactly what they were doing.
Hmm. That's terrifying. So they weren't actually exorcising the demons. They were just imprisoning the victims, which I imagine isn't the best fate.
No, probably isn't. Not very popular, I'm sure, among the people.
Yeah, I'm sure being buried alive with a demon for eternity isn't the ideal outcome of what they thought was happening with the exorcism. We have another one, the possession. This one is Turgot Volkov from his journals where we talk about Dominic Elderwood of Kellingford, Ireland. And he was known locally as a kind and generous man of, modest wealth. However, some had noticed he'd been talking to himself lately, gathering strange items like birds' nests, discarded clothing. He was even found sawing off the hooves of pigs. Then one day he was found on his roof completely nude, draining the blood of various ducks he'd captured from the local pond. So the locals were worried as to what was happening. You know, at this point, demonic possession is the go-to instead of like mental illness or something along those lines. And, there were other things that they said were happening, though, that would go to the idea of demonic possession. He was said to levitate above the trees at night, looking down at any wanderers or passersby. And out of concern, the local priest was contacted to check on the man. So he went, and upon visiting, the priest was left blind, yelling that he had been shown visions of hell by Mr. Elderwood. The church apparently wrote for help, and a strange man came to the town. Again, we have this process where, the church or whoever is informed, and, you know, they sent somebody. Now, Anna, you would say that this, what would be the chain of command, that it would go to the church and then...
Yes, it would go to the church and would go to the church, and then beneath the church at that point, the one church was truly in charge, and the one church would then send out their Salaminians.
Ah, I see. So it seems that after they wrote for help, this man appeared. And the man had an essence of darkness about him, it's written, and was covered in strange tattoos. Again, going back to Anna's point that he probably bared the sign of Solomon, it seems, this mysterious symbol that allows you to keep the demons within. The man identified himself as Turgo Volkov, and when entering the home of Dominic Elderwood, the town heard a great commotion. Interestingly, they heard the voices of not one, but two demons. One witness who dared to peek in the window said Volkov's eyes were black and he was holding Elderwood down with a giant monstrous arm, in that he was inhuman looking. And after a few days, Elderwood was exorcised and Mr. Volkov seemed even more foul than he had when he entered the village. It was interesting because the commentary around him was that he was this... He did not exude holiness. He did not exude piousness or anything. He exuded darkness. He was tainted almost. And, you know, this Turgo Volkov's exploits were documented by an interested party. He didn't write them himself. He was followed by this interested party who remained anonymous, and who eventually published it as the Chronicles of Turgo Volkov. Turgo was reported in various places around the world, often described as a cold, dark individual covered in strange tattoos. Even in some accounts, he's described to have inhuman, almost demonic features. He was supposedly responsible for hundreds of exorcisms in 1666. Can you speak to that, Anna, as to why he would have such a odd physical or spiritual presence about him?
Well, yes. I believe the Salaminians, when they do take in these demons, I believe that they take on traits of them. You know, think about it as almost taking in so much corruption that, you know, you start to have features of that corruption, or that they can perhaps even utilize the demons in them in some way. I'm not 100% sure, but I imagine the darkness that Turgo exuded had a lot to do with the fact that he had in prisons, you know, theoretically, hundreds of demons inside himself via the signs of Solomon. He is one of the most prolific of the Salaminians.
So they interesting that they would take on some of the demonic features. You know, if this, like I said, if this isn't all, you know, bullshit or what have you, or if these are not works of fiction. And then, you know, we also have the possession of Matthias Halvorsen. This one's interesting because this was, again, from the interviews with the damned, correct, Anna?
Yes, this possession of Matthias Halvorsen is really interesting because it's an interview with a demon known as Brithugsa. An interview with the damned is mostly an account of interviews with demonic entities. And, you know, they don't necessarily always take on the characteristics of Judeo-Christian mythology. They take on various characteristics of all sorts of different odd things. In this particular case, in a small village called Hitzvig in Norway, a man by the name of Matthias Halvorsen was said to be a hermit. He lived out in the woods by himself, and it, you know, came down to he made a deal with a demon to bring his daughter back. His daughter he only had one daughter, and she had died in a tragic accident. She had drowned, and he summarily buried her. And according to the legend, he needed to, according to the deal he made, he had to, needed to kill one of his kinsmen, wait until the body rotted, and then eat its flesh. just very odd and disgusting ritual, but that is what he was supposedly told to do. Various townsfolk saw the corpse of Matthias's daughter walk through the town, her body rotting and strange white worms occasionally slithering out her ears and mouth. Matthias was found in the cemetery eating dead bodies. So it very much goes against what, again, we see in Judeo-Christian type of things where we see speaking in tongues and whatnot. This has a lot to do with fruiting bodies and rot and in this kind of theme of worms.
As well as the theme of eating the body, mm-hmm. like eating the body of Christ.
Yeah.
So there are themes of consumption.
There can be that bird. Yeah. And Matthias was found, eventually letters were sent to the holy authorities at the time, who were, I believe, were mostly Protestant. And a strange man was sent wearing odd garbs, again, the red and black, and tattoos all over his body. There was also an entourage with a man who were similarly dressed. And one of the people there was to bear witness to this. Apparently was just a witness, didn't have any of the Solomonian type of characteristics. So when confronted, the demon performed strange miracles. For instance, it summoned strange white worms from the soil and showed off Matthias's dead daughter and her ability to speak and walk around. He was also eating the dead flesh of a corpse while talking to the priest. So he had an actual corpse sitting there and was devouring it as the priest stood there. And the demon called itself Brithoxa and said that it hailed from a place called the Bulge of the Fruiting Dead, which is interesting that they would refer to that. Again, not Judeo-Christian. It's, you know, it doesn't say Ganna, doesn't say Asheron or Armageddon or hell, but a bulge of the fruiting dead. And it said where it came from, there were mountains of rotting corpses and gadflies the size of elephants, and that the great god Sathugtha dead walked the body of something that he referred to as a bornless across the cosmos, which eternally eating of its flesh, which I've been unable to discern what that means. But it is said to live in cities of fruiting bodies and alien saprophytes and hurricanes of flesh-eating flies. And this is where it said it came from. And eventually it was said that a ritual involving salt, which is interesting, was thrown upon the possessed man and then a circle created around him of the staff. And eventually the demon was exorcised and taken into the strange priest. The daughter was killed and drowned in a mountain of salt. And that's how that particular account ended. So what we have here ultimately is this subterfuge type of organization orchestrating mass exorcisms across the world using this kind of esoteric technology. I won't see technology, but esoteric knowledge and symbolism to expedite the process or to kind of make these flesh and bone prisons. It's said that the Salaminians revere, interestingly, my sources told me that they revere and worship an angel called Orcus, which is the angel of exorcism. And the name was found in a Bible in Egypt, but was deemed blasphemous or incongruous, which is common with the Bible. It's usually considered apocryphal script, which is just that the information doesn't conform to the biblical mainstream ideas of what it should or shouldn't be, so it's taken out. But that this is one of their, I don't know if it's a gods or something they revere, but this angel called Orcus. That's mainly what I have is this idea that, you know, underlying the church, these many churches, not just Christianity, not just Catholicism or Protestants, it encompassed all of religions, at least the Abrahamic monotheistic ones. And they came together and formed this one church, which has just grown more powerful over the ages. And again, which is why I want to keep my identity anonymous.
Well, thanks, Anna. Really.
Well, yeah, Anna, thank you so much. That's completely understandable.
Yeah, and we'll definitely make sure that we keep everything anonymous, and we really appreciate you coming on the show. It's been great. You've been a font of knowledge. I didn't know half of these things. And the cases are just so bizarre that they're just really interesting. They deviate a lot from what we're used to seeing via the Catholic Church and what the types of possessions that they talk about. Especially that last one with the weird worms, that was especially odd, but just the idea of these people called the Salaminians. And do you know, Anna, if there are still Salaminians?
Oh, I believe so, yes. And in fact, from what I was told, the Salaminians are not only, they themselves are branded with the sign of Salomon, but they also, when they procreate, essentially, the sign is transferred onto the offspring. Except apparently that, from what I've been told, they don't necessarily bear the seal itself. It's almost like it's genetically passed on. They just innately can, these newer generations can innately imprison these demons. And again, I understand this gets all into conspiracy theories, and it all sounds extremely far-fetched. But I can't reveal my resource or my sources, and I can't reveal the physical evidence that I have and some of the things I've actually witnessed. But I can say for sure that this organization does exist. These people called the Salaminians do exist. And exorcisms still take place to this day. And the One Church isn't just the Salaminians. The One Church is a multifaceted, massive global organization that, I'm not quite sure what their intentions are. But it's, on the surface, it seems noble. But at the same time, why be so secretive about it?
Well, thank you, Anna. Again, we greatly appreciate you being on the show.
That was incredible. Thank you so much.
And So as always, we're left with some concluding thoughts.
More thoughts than anything. I was kind of silent for most of this because, Anna's report is just incredible, what she just told us and left us obviously with more questions than answers, but amazing information. In my preparation for the show, and from what I've kind of read and researched of the Dargo Volkov, he's been kind of pinpointed all over the world. But just in the region that he was predominant, I guess, in terms of where he left some very interesting impact, is in Krasnoyarsk, which is a very far region of Russia. It's basically Siberia. And there is a small town that is called Volkova, which could possibly originate from him, or at least named after him. A little town that was basically based around a small church, out of which came a young priest who then traveled to St. Petersburg by the name of Grigory Rasputin. And man had a very weird mythology. He was abnormally tall. Russians were not very tall at that time. This man was almost, was exceedingly almost 7 foot tall, dark eyes, had his own entire mythology in terms of his own Christianity or whatever he wanted to call it, where essentially he believed that people needed to sin. And in his own right, if you look into his writings and those around him who have conscripted some of his writings, he would often say one must ingest sin in order for him to go to church, that he would say you have no other point of going to church unless you have ingested sin right before. Now, from what Anna told us, you know, what we know about the Solomonians, Grigory Rasputin also followed a very interesting kind of look to him. Besides just having those, like, very, very ice-cold dark eyes, possessing what has been reported supernatural abilities, like healing, talking to animals, things like that. But beyond that, just his appearance was he wore black. Black suits, what do you want to call it? These would be priests, kind of adorned priests' clothing, but it would be lined with red silk. And the parallels are just, they're kind of there, you know?
Do you think he could have been Turgo, changed his name, and just kind of living out his
life? This would give him an incredibly supernatural longevity. This was way past Targo. He could be a descendant. He comes out of this bizarre place, small town built around this really weird church in a town that bears Volkova, the name meaning belonging to Volkov. And he had this very weird take on Christianity, and he had this all encompassing kind of grip over the Russian monarchy, over the Tsarina, over the Tsar, right until their end, you know. So definitely had this weird mythology where he literally says one must ingest sin if they were to go to church. And if you can understand anything about that society at that time before the communists came, is that everything was revolving around the church, you know, that the church was also crowning the princes and then the queens and the kings, and it was kind of revolving around that, and he was in control virtually of a country at one point. And this very, very bizarre guy that came out of nowhere, out of Siberia, out of a town called Volkova. And yeah, black, adorned black kind of clothing, lined with what was only described as red silk.
That's very interesting. Well, it could be. It'd be interesting to see if it was a descendant of this Turgo, and more evidence to, you know, wonder if he was part of this one church, if it exists.
Yeah, possibly.
Well, that's almost all our time. We hope you enjoyed the show, and as always, we'll conclude with our what do you think,
well,
Sasha?
My question to you is what do you think of it? You know, what can you make of this?
Well, based on Anna seems a believable source. The consistencies are staggering.
The amount of information we've got. I mean, that's amazing. I'm really appreciative. Again, Anna, thank you so much. I appreciate you being on the show.
Oh, that's my pleasure.
Yeah, and I think across the various books, you have so many similarities, and they came from so many different origins. I mean, I don't know if any of these people knew each other, but, you know, at the time, the communication was, you know, amazingly slow. So, you know, I doubt these people had communication with one another or, you know, collaborated. So I think this one church thing and these Solomonians, you know, could very well be real.
Yeah. Well, you know me, for me, it's, I'm not saying it's aliens.
Yep. It's going to be,
I don't know,
but it, they're demonic,
be, could
aliens.
Be tattooing aliens, you know, it could be aliens just running around tattooing people, you know, possessing them. How far is abduction from possession? You know, I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens.
It's true. It's always true. Aliens are the source of all things.
Always.
So
that's right.
We will leave you with those thoughts. And as always, thank you very much for joining the Weird Book. And we will talk to you later.
All right. Thanks so much, everybody. Talk to you later. Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.